If you could begin by locating a map without losing your place. You really want a map of the eastern part of the Mediterranean. If you've got a map that speaks of Paul's missionary journeys or something like that, that would be ideal. But you want one that gives you, preferably in the days, not in so much in the days of the Old Testament, but in the days of the New, just this little bit. There's just two things that I want to be able to show to you, really. And one is this, that Athens, where Paul was, and then he went to Corinth, is not very far. You can see them on the map, they're quite close together there, probably not even 50 miles. So that it really is not very far at all. Have you got them marked on your map there? Right, okay.
I never could read maps.
Yeah, there we are. That's the end of Greece, you see. And I don't know if Athens is meant to be. There's Corinth. Yes, it's Athens and there's Corinth. And can you see that Corinth is on an isthmus? But for that little bit that joins there, you could get right the way through and the Peloponnese would be an island. So it had two ports, one on each coast, and the early traders, before the days we're talking about, would bring their boats to one side and draw them the 5 miles across to the other to say sailing all the way around. So that's the one thing that I just wanted to notice. And the other thing is that Aquila came from Pontus. Now, can you, if you were down there looking at Greece, can you now look up at what is now the Black Sea? And that was known as the Euxine Sea, or the Pontus, which is a word for sea. It gives us our word pond, Pontus, Euxinus there. So that's it up there. Now, you can probably see that you've got an area marked, Bithynia and Pontus, along that northern seacoast of what is now Turkey, along there. And so Pontus was that area that bordered the sea, and it was inhabited, it was a Gentile area, but it was inhabited by a lot of Jews. And the thought is, I mean, I don't know the history of the Jews in that sense, that these were not Jews so much from Jerusalem, but when the Jews who had been in exile were scattered and returned home, many of them didn't actually go to Jerusalem, but sort of came over this way and settled all along here. And that probably he would have been a descendant of those. So Pontus is the reason around here. Not so very far from the area where later Byzantium became well known, or Constantinople as we would have known it. And just further south of there is the place Nicaea, which is well known to us from the Nicene Creed and from a famous hymn tune, which is given that name. So that's Pontus when it speaks of that. Italy, of course. Italy, well, you know Italy, don't you? It's just here from Greece. So he'd come from Rome, and they'd come from Rome and they'd came to Corinth, you see, but he came from Pontus. So he came from Pontus, he'd been living with his wife in Rome. Claudius threw them out of Rome, all the Jews, and so he came to Corinth. That's the... And also, while we're just there, Ephesus is over the water from here. Can you see where that is on this edge of Turkey there? So, because that's they also went to Ephesus, and Paul also went to Ephesus. Now, I would have incorporated that in my address, really, but because we had the map open, it seemed a sensible thing to do, and we'll just go through the verses now. So we read that after Athens, Paul departed and came to Corinth. Corinth was a very ancient city, and it is liable to earthquakes. I heard somewhere filed in my memory that in the 20th century, it had two major earthquakes right at the beginning of the century and had to be rebuilt completely on one of those occasions. So we don't have nowadays the modern Corinth. But ancient Corinth was a seafaring place. Ancient Corinth was a meeting of the ways between east and west. It was a very big city by the standards of that time. Had a massive temple. One commentator, where he got his facts from, I don't know, but one commentator suggests that there were 400 prostitutes in the temple of Venus that place. And that in that lay the root of the Corinthian problem, because they were brought up on that. Many of them no doubt have been involved in that. Some of them no doubt didn't want to give it up, or didn't see that being a Christian meant giving that sort of thing up. It may not only have been that, but it was that sort of a place. And that makes it particularly, what's the word I was going to say, fascinating, I don't mean the word fascinating, particularly interesting for modern evangelism even. That the Lord had much people in that city, that among, if you like, the worst, among the ones who were exposed to the greatest vice and the greatest lewdness, the Lord told Paul to stay put in order that he might preach the gospel there over a longish period, and many might be saved. So, that was Corinth. He found there a certain Jew named Aquila, born in Pontus, lately come from Italy, so you now know what all that means, with his wife Priscilla. Sometimes that name is reduced to Prisca. Because Claudius, that's the fourth, is he the third? One, two, I can't remember if he's the third or the fourth emperor. Julius Caesar, Augustus, Claudius the third, I think. And he was about 54 AD. And he'd commanded all Jews to depart from Rome. But that's very interesting in dating the letter in a way. So this would be being written, or not the letter, but the things that were happening at Corinth were happening in the mid-50s, 22 years after Jesus had died. So we're moving on at that sort of thing. And if you like, in 18 chapters, we've moved on 22 years from the time of Christ's death. And so it was, because Paul was a tent maker, and he met up with them, he stayed with them, and obviously they shared their work, perhaps shared their outlets when it came to selling the things that they made. But every Sabbath day he reasoned and persuaded the Jews and the Greeks. Now you mustn't be misled by that word, persuaded the Jews and the Greeks, because we see in a minute or two that they were very hostile towards him on a subsequent occasion. By persuading, he just meant that he preached to them persuasively, not necessarily convincing them, not necessarily persuading them to change their mind, but that he used his persuasive methods. He moved with the preaching of the gospel, and the Spirit began to touch their hearts. So he reasoned with them and he persuaded them. When he says he speaks not words of man's wisdom, that doesn't mean to say he can't reason and he can't persuade. This is part of the method. But we reason and persuade concerning the truth of the Lord Jesus, and the actual out-reasoning is the Lord's work. Now, there used to be, when I was at Oxford, this thing that you could really believe anything, but you were to talk to other students and they persuaded you, they really did expect you to change your mind to them. If you knew you were right, but you still couldn't muster the arguments to deal with it, you were still supposed to change your views until you could swap it round the other way, a bit like Game of Conkers. But that was the sort of ethos, that you were expected to be able to defend your position, and if you couldn't defend it satisfactorily, you were expected to desert it, abandon it, and take on the one of the person who out-persuaded you. And that was, in a way, very challenging. And I wouldn't have thought it was kept to the letter by any means, but it was sort of there as a three-quarters unwritten sort of code. So the persuading is a very important item of the gospel, that we should seek to persuade men, to reason with them, to talk with them. And again, this is what we seek to do in a gospel service. It's what we seek to do in the letters that we send out. Now, when Silas and Timotheus were come from Macedonia... Now, we know that Paul waited for them in Athens, but afterwards he sent Timothy to Thessalonica, as you can read in the letter to the Thessalonians. And it was after they'd returned from that trip that Paul was pressed in the Spirit. Now, that's very interesting, isn't it? How moved he was in the Spirit, how grieved he was in the Spirit at Athens when he saw the altar. And now he's moved and pressed in the Spirit, particularly to testify to the Jews that Jesus was Christ. Now, you see, when he persuaded the Jews and the Greeks, according to verse 4, he was doing that. This doesn't mean that he now took on a different tack and sought to persuade, testify to the Jews that Jesus was Christ, because he hadn't done it before. What he means is that there was a new urgency. He found perhaps new texts, or perhaps he found new reasons. Perhaps he tried a new approach. But always he testified to the Jews that Jesus was Christ, but it was the manner in which he did it, the strength in which he did it, the commitment with which he did it at this particular time, and the blessing of the Spirit that made them oppose themselves in a way that they didn't before. Sometimes when people don't actually see where your argument's leading, they're quite happy. But once the penny drops and they see what you're driving at, then not only did they say, well, I'm not going any further on this line, they can be quite full of opposition. And so we read there that they opposed themselves and blasphemed, which was the usual Jewish way of opposition. Blaspheme the name of Christ. They wouldn't blaspheme the name of God, of course. But not the Jews wouldn't. But they blasphemed concerning Jesus, saying that he was not the Son of God and so on. And then Paul shook his raiment and said, your blood be upon your own heads. And this was something that particularly comes out of Ezekiel, doesn't it? I've made you a watchman unto my people, and if you say, speak the word from my lips, and they don't heed it, then you're clear, but their blood, I will visit them for their blood. And it appears that it was this sort of thing that he was saying to them, and they understood, your blood be upon your own heads. I am clean, or clear from this matter. From henceforth I will go unto the Gentiles. And I think at that time he wasn't expecting to stay any longer than he'd stayed at other places. That perhaps, all right, he'd be with the Jews a month or so, and perhaps he might be with the Gentiles a month or so, and then move on. But the Lord indicated otherwise. And he departed from there and entered into a certain man's house named Justus, one that worshipped God, whose house joined hard to the synagogue. Now, it looks as if this man was actually a Jew. When he says, I will go to the Gentiles, I don't think he meant he would have no further connection with the Jews. Some commentators think he did, because, you see, he left Aquila and Priscilla's house. And maybe this man, Justus, was a Gentile believer. But maybe he just changed residences, and maybe this man was, in fact, a Jewish man. Well, we don't know for certain, but we read that he worshipped God and his house joined hard to the synagogue. And while he was at that time, Crispus, the chief ruler of the synagogue, believed on the Lord with all his house. That's a very interesting comment, because although Paul moved away and although Paul never went back to the synagogue, the leader of the synagogue obviously followed him. Or very soon afterwards believed, without Paul ever going back into the synagogue to preach to him. So probably the very thing that made all the other synagogue members oppose themselves and blaspheme turned Crispus by the Spirit to believe. Maybe he was more noble than they were. Sometimes the leaders in the synagogue felt they had to live up to their position and turned against the things. But here was a man who clearly, being the chief ruler of the synagogue, left the synagogue and believed on the Lord with all his house. And you'll see, if you look to verse 17, the Greeks took Sosthenes, the chief ruler of the synagogue, and beat him. So you've got another chief ruler of the synagogue. It just looks as if following Crispus is becoming a Christian. They then had to appoint another one whose name was Sosthenes. So you've got this position now that very near to the synagogue was the place where the Christians met, but he didn't go to the synagogue, and the chief ruler of the synagogue believed on the Lord with all his house. Now, can you just imagine the position? There's a church in Wiltshire, I remember, where the Anglican church the church of those who seceded from the Anglican church, they built their place right bang next door. And can you just imagine, you see, Paul says, I'm not ever going back to you, your blood be upon your own head. So he moves to the house next door, and the former chief ruler of the synagogue is seen with his family every Lord's Day, well, every Sabbath day, coming next door to worship, plus the others who had joined him. You can see that this sows the seed of the
the uprising that there's going to be not very long ahead. You can just understand the way that the events simmered during this particular occasion. And bear in mind that this is the place also where the Corinthian letters were written to. This is the same place we're dealing with, the letters that we afterwards read to Corinth. These were the early days in Corinth. And many of the Corinthians, hearing, they believed and were baptized. Notice you always get believing before baptism. It's just in passing there, but the order is perfectly correct there. Then spake the Lord to Paul in the night by a vision. Be not afraid, but speak, and hold not thy peace, for I am with thee. Notice that the vision speaks words of Scripture. Be not afraid, for I am with thee. Command to Joshua, repeated down the years in many other places. Be not afraid, for I am with thee. And perhaps it was that Paul could see this simmering. And because he'd moved on in preaching the gospel from one place to another fairly frequently, maybe he was just thinking at that time that maybe now is the time when I could leave the church. Here, there's enough officers, there's enough, they've been baptized. I could leave them and go on to another place. Maybe these things were in his mind so that the Lord brings to him a vision, in which he brings a revelation from the Old Testament scriptures as well. And he says, be not afraid, but speak and hold not thy peace, for I am with thee. And no man shall sit on thee to hurt thee. Now, there's going to be an uprising, and they do start on Paul. But he doesn't get hurt, does he? And he's not the one who gets beaten up. So this was actually quite literally fulfilled. Paul himself, in the events that transpired, was protected. For I have much people in this city. Well, I just alluded to that. You can't say that of every place that you go to, every place where a church is set up. But clearly the Lord had chosen to locate a large number of his elect people in this very wicked city. It was something of an urban conglomeration. That is, people came from all over. Like, they'd come from Italy. People did come from all over, and it was a good place. But clearly the Lord had designed to bring many people to that city, or they were already living there, who would be saved. Many of the Lord's elect. And it's very interesting, you see, that he was, in effect, he was going to spend another 18 months there. But they weren't all there at the beginning, it would transpire. Don't think it was just a matter of it would take 18 months to build them up because he left other places. But that he was required to stay there because there was a lot of follow-up teaching to do. But because, no doubt, some of the people who were elect and who were going to be saved were either not yet upon the scene or hadn't yet heard of what was going on, or in some ways hadn't been brought under the sound of the gospel. So the Lord very graciously gives them time, provides the opportunities, but commands Paul to stay put. He continued there a year and 6 months, teaching the word of God among them. So whether that refers to the total or whether it was from that time onwards, it doesn't really matter very much. Now, Gallio was the deputy of Achaia. That is to say, he was the Roman officer in charge of what we know as the Peloponnese. You remember when we were looking at that little, virtually an island, but it was just had that little strip. Well, that's the area that is generally known as Achaia, with a bit more slightly to the north there. It would include the area of Olympia, but not of Delphi. Well, Delphi would be just to the north of the river or the sea that was just on the western side there. He was a very important Roman officer and very well connected. He was the brother of a very famous Roman philosopher called Seneca, who was the instructor of one of the emperors. And his name was not Seneca because he'd been adopted to be brought up, as Romans sometimes did, among a noble family, and he took on their name. But even the Romans others described Gallio's temperament as sweet. Now, when you compare that with Pilate and other places, he was known to be a most reasonable, personable, pleasant sort of man. And I think when you read, therefore, about what follows as he drove them from the judgment seat, you must mitigate. You've either got to say that here was a man who didn't quite live up to his normal way of handling things when he was dealing with the Jews, or else because they were so exasperating, or that he acted perfectly reasonably, and as reasonably as a sweet-tempered man could do with such contrary sort of people. But do bear in mind that he is not your typical Roman governor in the sense of brutality, in the sense of cruelty, in the sense of double dealing, in the sense of being bought with money for a price by whoever wanted. He has a reputation of being both sweet. One Roman writer actually uses the word sweet, dulce, of him. And, you know, that's, in a way, quite a compliment for a man who rises up to that sort of height. He had contact with his brother, was probably influenced by his brother's philosophical approach. Seneca wrote some books which those who study Latin usually have to read, and so on. So he was well connected, he was highly placed. So when Gallio was the deputy of Zacchaeus, remember that Paul always uses the exact term, it might be governor in one place, but it's a deputy here. The Jews made insurrection with one accord against Paul. So it didn't happen for a little while, you see. We don't know at what period of this 18 months it was. We know he stayed a good while after this, because we're told that, but how much of the 18 months, we don't know. So obviously they've been building up. And so one day the Jews made insurrection with one accord against Paul, and they brought him to his judgment seat. And they said to Gallio, "This fellow persuadeth men to worship God contrary to the law." Now, Gallio makes, if you like, a correct, instant decision. He makes up his mind that this man, Paul, has done nothing contrary to Roman law. That's why he says, if it be a matter of your laws, I don't want to know. So he is really saying, if you say he's done something contrary to the law, and there was a law in force that people weren't supposed to introduce new gods, I think Christianity had been accepted in some places for quite persecuted a bit, but it was known. It was known in Italy sufficiently, and certainly Claudius drove them all out of Rome. But it was thought in Claudius' case that it was a political manoeuvre. It wasn't that he hated the Christians particularly, but he had all these, even in Rome he had the Jews arguing about it with the Christians, and he thought the best way was to get rid of the lot, rather than that he had a vendetta against them as other emperors later did, particularly Nero, who was his successor. So it looks here as if Gallio sees through the Jews here, and he says to them, Paul is about to open his mouth, so he interrupts Paul, and he said to the Jews, because Paul is a Jew as well, he may see the Christians and Jews all as one, as Claudius probably did, if it were a matter of wrong or wicked lewdness, reason would that I should bear with you. In other words, if they had broken the Roman law in any capacity, its moral law, which wasn't very high, or any sort of law in that way, he said, I'd listen. But if it's a question of words, names, and of your law, he obviously wasn't the least bit interested in the Bible, or in the synagogue worship, or in anything that had to do with Jewish culture. He was a thoroughgoing Roman philosopher, if you like his brother. If it be a question of words and names and your law, I will be judge of no such matters. Keep it within yourselves. Look to it yourself. I don't want to know. Now, you may think that's reasonable, you may think that's unreasonable, you may think he could have made a better job. No Roman governor in dealing with the Christians at this stage made a better fist of it than he. It's a question of whether you think he should or could have done better. And he actually drove them from the judgment seat. He just didn't want to know. He put out a long and sound example that the Jewish arguments he didn't want to know anything about. So all the Greeks took Sosthenes. Now, why would the Greeks? These are unbelieving Greeks now. It's their town, Corinth. It's their city. So they all now say, because you see, they think they've got involved in this in a bit, and they've seen all that's been going on, and they think, all right, Gary doesn't want anything to do with it, we'll have a field day here. So you get unrestrained sin, bearing in mind that the civil leader should restrain sinful acts of man. All the Greeks took Sosthenes, the chief ruler of the synagogue, and beat him before the judgment seat. So before he got a chance to move away, there was a bit of an insurrection, and the Jews grabbed hold of the chief ruler of the synagogue, Sosthenes, for whom they didn't have much sympathy. And bearing in mind what Gallio had just said, they gave him a beating right there, and Gallio took no notice, whatever. Now, why they went for Sosthenes is difficult to tell, unless in verse 12 you understand that when it says the Jews made insurrection with one accord, with one heart against Paul, that it had all been coordinated by Sosthenes. If that was the case, you could understand why he in particular was involved in this, why he was there anyway, and why they so particularly wanted to get hold of Sosthenes. Now, there's an interesting little thing here. Without losing the place, if you can turn up to 1 Corinthians chapter 1. And verse 1. Paul, called to be an apostle of Jesus Christ through the will of God, and I've got with me Sosthenes, our brother, unto the church of God which is at Corinth. It's not the most common of names. One wonders if he wasn't converted too subsequently, you see. We don't actually know, but I suspect it's the same Sosthenes. And it's Corinth after all, and the name doesn't occur in scripture anywhere else, so it does look as if he subsequently became converted as well. And at that point, just for a minute, because Priscilla and Aquila come up again, I'm just going to give you a slight breathing spot and talk again about Aquila and Priscilla, and also just a little bit about Pontus. If you, without losing the place, turn to the later part of this chapter, verse 26, you see that Aquila and Priscilla are mentioned there. But if you compare that with verse 24, sorry, we're in Acts of the Apostles here, same chapter we're dealing with, you move on from where we are, where I just stopped. Later on in Acts 18 to verse 26, you see there's a mention again of Aquila and Priscilla, okay? And if you look at verse 24, you see that he's not there, but they're at Ephesus. They went with Paul to Ephesus, okay? So Aquila and Priscilla moved about a bit, didn't they? Connection with their trade. They had this house. Having been moved from Italy, they were able to rent or purchase a house for their trade in Corinth. And then they moved to Ephesus. And then in 2 Timothy, look up Romans 16 next. Just a little bit about these people. In chapter 16 of Romans, verse 3. Greet Priscilla and Aquila, my helpers in Jesus Christ, who for my life laid down their own necks. That expression seems to be unusual to us. But of course, if someone was being beheaded, that's what they did. That's what Charles I did, put his neck down. So it was just an expression. They weren't physically killed, but it's just an expression for they were prepared to lay down their lives. And to whom not only I give thanks, but also all the churches of the Gentiles. Now, you wouldn't have known that about Priscilla and Aquila, but for that comment there of Paul. Maybe he's referring to the incident before the judgment seat of Gallio. We don't actually know, but that's just another bit of information. Then we have 2 Timothy 4:19. Paul writes, salute Prisca, there's the shorter name of Priscilla. Salute Prisca and Aquila and the household of Onesiphorus, or Onesiphorus if you like. And there, of course, he's writing to Timothy, and wherever Timothy is, then clearly if he's to greet Priscilla and Aquila, they must be there too. Now, there's a little thing at the end of that chapter which says, the second epistle unto Timotheus, ordained the first bishop of the Church of the Ephesians, was written from Rome when Paul was brought before Nero the second time. Now, sometimes these little notes at the end are factually correct, sometimes they're not. They're not part of the inspired writings, they're not part of the original text, they're just comments that people have been put in, and they're perhaps right. Now, that one is probably right. They were at Ephesus, and Paul wrote it from Rome. But when you turn to 1 Corinthians 16 and verse 19. The churches of Asia salute you. That's the church at Corinth. Aquila and Priscilla salute you much in the Lord with the church that is in their house. Well, you'd understand them greeting the Corinthians, wouldn't you? But when it says at the bottom that the first epistle to the Corinthians was written from Philippi, that would give another place where they lived. But it is generally thought that that particular note is in error. Most commentators that I've come across think that that comment, the first epistle to the Corinthians was written from Philippi by Stephanus, Fortunatus, Achaicus and Timotheus, is in error, if not in all its particulars, certainly in some of them. But bear in mind that those little things put at the end are not part of the sacred scriptures. They're just comments that have been put in later days and are generally accepted, but sometimes they're not. Now, about Pontus, I thought you would be just interesting just to know particularly. If you turn to the first letter of Peter, the first place named, Chapter 1, verse 1. Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ, to the strangers scattered throughout Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia. Well, now you know where Pontus is. But you see, obviously there were Christians there. They were Jewish strangers, means that they didn't often get to Jerusalem. Didn't mean that they were non-Jews. But these were Jewish Christians scattered throughout Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia. Thought you'd be interested. And just in case it hadn't twigged, if you look at Acts 2, of course, Day of Pentecost, do you remember? And verse 8. How hear we every man in our own tongue wherein we were born? Parthians and Medes and Elamites and dwellers in Mesopotamia and in Judea and Cappadocia, in Pontus, in Asia, Phrygia and Pamphylia. Pontus there in the middle. So on the day of Pentecost, there were Christians, there were Jews who had come and who heard the preaching at Pentecost. It is possible, you see, therefore, that Aquila had been there then, or he'd been under the direct influence of those who'd been converted under the day of Pentecost and had gone back to Pontus. The whole thing isn't quite as mysterious as coming out of nowhere, you see, when you just can link those names up. Now, I would have liked to have gone on just a little further, because verse 24 begins a new section, but I think I will have to begin at verse 18 next time, as our time is up.